Welcome to Rise, the Choice Machine Music, a new podcast made possible through the generous support of the MSU Federal Credit Union.
You know, really, you don't decide to be in music. It was always there. Again, you know, I mean, you kind of had this support system in the city of Detroit where everybody's interested in music. So a turntable is something that maybe if you don't have, your neighbor has, or if someone else has, and you just borrow it, or you go and play around with it. I started using a turntable maybe 13 years old.
That was Jeff Mills, also known as The Wizard. Mills started his career in the 1980s, DJing on the radio and eventually helping to establish underground resistance. Mills is a perfect example of the central importance of the DJ. That's what this episode is about. Episode 4, The DJ, Inventor, Innovator, Instigator.
The whole history of Detroit techno started, I suppose you could say, from Kevin Saunderson, Juan Atkins, and Derek May.
I think we were like way ahead of our time, like 10, 15 years.
Juan had this vision of what he thought the future was all about, what he thought life itself should be projected as in the future. And we became friends, and it was his way of thinking, you know, and it was really fast forward, and it was interesting, and it was something we had never seen before in our lives, man.
So we all went to high school together, me, Juan, and Derek. Derek learned from Juan, basically, which I think started for him in 70, maybe 79, with a group called Cybertron.
That clip from Detroit, The Blueprint of Techno, a documentary commissioned by the Canadian music channel Much Music in 1998, is a perfect way to start this episode. The documentary offered an overview of the rise and importance of techno at that moment in time. The documentary captures the voices of figures like Mike Huckabee, Juan Atkins, Derek May, and Kevin Saunderson, among others. In some ways, the story articulated then has not evolved much in the 27 years since it aired. In that story, the originators, Atkins, May, and Saunderson, are central figures, experimenting and creating what comes to be known as techno. While it's true those figures are central, one of the ideas that drives our new exhibition, Techno, The Rise of the Choice Machine Music, is that there is more to that story.
The one person who we don't talk about a lot is Eddie Folks, who was definitely there at the beginning. I kind of feel that Eddie Folks should be included somewhere because he's from the beginning as well. And some people consider him the fourth founder.
That was John Collins, the community curator for Techno, The Rise of the Choice Machine Music, and curator of Exhibit 3000, the techno museum founded in Detroit. There was an interplay between culture and practice happening in Detroit, with DJs on the airwaves and in the clubs creating the music and culture that moved techno forward. In that story, the work of the DJ working in the radio station is pivotal, as Stacy Hotwax Hale explains.
We were number 7 in the market overall in the country. The radio was so much fun. It was competitive. We knew who the DJs were on the radio. Mojo being the rebel, you know, I can't think, and I don't think it's ever happened. And if it did, maybe I just don't have the knowledge. But who can stop a complete city and have everybody go outside and turn on the porch light because he said so? We live and die by that. It's like, what? And not to mention that the music he played, because it'd be music that you never heard before. Him and Prince were very good friends. So with him being so open like that, that opened up the world of techno being going to be able to be played. And so you got to hear that. We were a generation looking to be different.
The difference that Hale alludes to is an important part of the sonic geography created by the choice DJs, working both on the airwaves and in the club. For scholars interested in Afrofuturism, communities created by sound practice are important drivers of the ideology of futurity central to the music. Here, Tobias C. Van Veen talks about the importance of radio.
I think radio remains a very potent, powerful force right up all the way through the 20th century. I encountered Afrofuturism in a way sonically through late night radio. It was through DJs playing Detroit techno late night on college radio in Vancouver, which is a narrative that actually goes back decades of white kids hearing black music on the radio and just hearing the sound this is a complicated narrative because you have plenty of white folk who like the sound, but then can't deal with the black culture and black people, and the love stops there. So it's not necessarily like the sound is all the labor and sort of transforms you, but it can lead you there. It can have a very potent force. It definitely led me there.
With like the very real challenge that Debye Van Dean is alluding to here, the fact remained that clubs in Detroit became interracial spaces where the music of techno, or the music that would become techno, is being celebrated.
And during this space of time, what I liked the best about it, there was also an experimental in terms of an MC and the DJ really seemed to manage people's emotions better than they do now.
This is Ronaldo Amshon talking about the way that the DJ acted as a kind of mediator, creating community through their work in the club.
Yeah, we might have some rap music, but after the end of the slow drag piece, then they start amping it up with techno as the closer you got into midnight. So it's kind of like you might start out a party with Run DMC, and then they slow it down a little bit to maybe you dance to some Whitney Houston. But then right around 11 to 12 o'clock last night, they're going to amp it up with some Detroit techno. So back then, the DJ and the MC were almost like a preacher and the choir director managing the emotions of a church. You know, for a 3 to 4 hour period, they understood tempo, tone, what sound was needed for certain types of movement, because it was about creating an experience. And in the context of this tonal experience of sound, there was also some intimacy that would take place. Okay. So the MC and the DJ would create a setting for all of this type of whatever kind of intimacy you would characterize it to take place. So the music, what music was played, when it was played, how it was played, always set the scene for these cross-cultural connections that were creating space for people to form relationships.
Relationships being formed in Detroit mirror a series of activities that are also taking place in Chicago.
These things inside my soul, they make me
as Stacy Hill explains, the definition of the sounds wasn't as clear-cut as we might imagine at the beginning, but the interplay was crucial.
Techno and house, those titles didn't exist yet, although they were clearly being played, but even we didn't know how to identify it. That falls back into, we just want to be underground, we want to be different. You think back in the 70s and 80s, you couldn't go anywhere and just get that. You had to go to a particular place to get that different because it wasn't played on the radio and it wasn't mainstream in the clubs.
One of the things we tried to do while creating the exhibition is to understand who are the figures who were providing sort of guidance and acting as a bridge between previous generations of musical innovation and the emerging conversation around techno.
And in particular, let's start with Ken Collier. Now, he wasn't the only one that was bridging that music as well, but he's focused on because he may be the most popular person, you know, and there were other DJs, including myself, that was also doing that, including Stacy Hill, including some other people.
You know, when I first saw him, I went and saw how it was done, and I immediately, it was my sole decision when I decided to be a DJ. It was him, Dwayne Bradley, Renato White, and Morris Mitchell that I actually saw performing.
This is Stacy Hill talking about Ken Collier.
And they didn't have a clue. I was already into it, but from my own perspective, that wasn't that. I had no idea that two turntables and a mixer that you could mix, but I saw that and I made that decision right then that this is what I was going to do.
As we researched the exhibition, it became clear that Collier's impact was profound, particularly as a figure bridging the gap between disco, house, and techno. He developed his own style in that post-disco era that arguably acknowledged the legacy of Motown, but embraced the emerging technology and sounds of house and techno. As a resident DJ at Club Heaven, he also played a crucial role providing mentorship for new DJs, producers, and promoters entering into the scene.
We stayed more on the dance circuit, and what stuff would come out that would be just a twisted, a little bit different. And I remember taking Delight to Heaven one time. Mm. And again, that was a different sound. Now that I think of Delight music, is not house, it's not techno, it's not new wave. It's kind of a crash of all of it together and fun. And, you know, what he did by way of club and bringing music to the underground is the same thing that Mojo did on the radio, where he would play the B-side to everything. He put Jeff Mills on the radio, which playing techno, you know, he didn't have to be programmed. As you know, mainstream radio today, where it's connected. But these two people put it on the biggest platform that we had to put it on.
Recovery is a central tenet for futurism. Can we understand how past innovators who have been overlooked can be reintegrated into the story? In the case of techno, John Collins reminds us that we can continue to laud the founding generation that we know well, while also calling attention to those names that we might have overlooked.
As with the founders of techno music, you know, we hear about Juan, Kevin, Derek, and Eddie, but there's also James Pennington. He did a lot of work on Good Life and Big Flood with Kevin Saunderson, which a lot of people don't know. You know, so like you utilize, you know, and Detroit was sort of like connected, and we may have a track and call up somebody, say, hey, Eddie, you know, what do you think about this? What do you know? Come listen, blah, blah, blah. So you're getting feedback and sometimes information or that you may want to use. So it's like, we're kind of like working together, even though it's my track, but they will kind of help you or inspire you to, or you might like a suggestion that they have to make your track better or your edit or remix. Add this or take this away. What do you think? Ultimately, that producer or DJ is making a decision, but we take input from other people.
The creative process at techno's core depends on bands created in real time by DJs at clubs and more nuanced collaborations in the studio.
It's live. I mean, it's live music.
That is Omar Mel.
The patches on the synthesizers and the drum sounds that they might be using might sound electronic or might be from a machine, but at the end of the day, there's a person behind. Even if you've ever watched any of those videos of Jeff Mills when he just plays with just TR-808, the way he's playing it, he's not just hitting play and standing there and just letting a sequence run. He's genuinely manipulating all the sounds and the release and the attack on certain things and the levels and the velocity.
John Collins expands on this idea that there is a relationship that's created by the DJ in the live space where they're in communication with the crowd.
It depends on the reaction from the crowd and the energy that is flowing from the crowd to back to the crowd. So that's not on the fly. That's creating as you go along. You have to form a connection with your crowd. I've seen up and coming and other people just playing tracks that made no sense and confusing the crowd, that type of thing, which means they're not really connected. And I think it's something you learn later, unless you go to a lot of DJ schools now where they may tell you how you should connect with the crowd and let an organic flow occur, or even to the point where the crowd can move you in the direction of the next track you should play, but not the name of it. But you're watching the crowd, they're reacting, the music is grooving. They're like, okay, I got to play this next or something similar. You know, just you get a feeling, but the name of that track is not there, but you have something that works. And to me, that's the best DJing. You can take them on the musical journey. The action, the energy, how they're moving, and what part of the track is really energizing them or enable them to really express how they're feeling on the dance floor. Because as a DJ, that's why you see some DJs are looking down all the time. They're not watching the crowd at all. You have to look up at what your crowd is doing. Because I've seen DJs lose dance floors because Wow. Their heads are down. They're playing for themselves. They're not looking at what the people is doing. And they look up and everybody's gone or half your dance floor is gone. And that's something that I think people learn over time.
In the end, the experience that DJs created through their live performance are mirrored in many ways by the collaborative efforts that emerged in the studio. Creative culture that long defined Detroit, a culture that learned from previous generations, celebrating new ideas, came together in the album these innovators started to produce in the studio. Techno, the Rise of Detroit's Machine Music Exhibition, features a sound installation created by Underground Resistance, a fitting choice as the DIY aesthetic and celebration of local artists at the core of that group's really depended on mutual support and celebration of the local, as John Collins explains.
Let's just take Underground Resistance. You know, we have, could be several DJs working on one track. People don't really know that, you know, or they work together, collaborating or pre-production, you know, it's more than one person, but it might be, let's just say, if you are a DJ, it would be DJ Julian's track, but other DJs may have contributed something. So I think that works really, really well. And I think it also as to the longevity of music coming out of Detroit, techno music and house, one more techno house, because our music is timeless. And a lot of tracks that were made in the 80s and 90s, still to this day, I'm talking about Detroit, you can still play in a club or a festival and people will go crazy. Well, then some of them have never heard it before either because they're, you know, it's a younger generation coming up, so it might be new music to them, but it's so good that it's accepted. You know, all DJs and producers don't have that power.
Detroit's cultural importance never went away for those who love and cherish the music created in the city. As Omar Mehta recounts here, Detroit sound remained definitional for many, regardless of the challenges the city might have been facing.
You know, it never died. Like, a lot of people think like, oh man, like Detroit kind of like fell off in the 90s and 2000s because, you know, the economy and stuff. But even, you know, Giles Peterson told me that he was the one that ran, I think it was Talking Loud Records in London. And he was the one that signed Incognito. And when I met him, he was here like a year ago and I played a party with him. He had told me, he was like, honestly, I haven't been to Detroit in 20 years. And I can say Detroit single-handedly was what saved my whole career. He's like, I put out the Incognito record and we didn't realize like that most of these record sales were right here in Detroit. And so he made it a point to come to the stadium event. I think, I don't know where it was. It had to have been at Palace in Arbor Hills or something.
Awesome.
He said when he came here, he had no idea what to expect. And it was just like a stadium. And he was like, holy shit, like, oh, everything in Detroit. It's just like a second nature. I don't know if it's something in the water. I don't know. It's just the geographical location. I don't know what it is, but there's something very special and unique relationship that people have with music.
That special relationship continues to define Detroit, where the conversation about techno and other creative endeavors, the city remains a hub of innovation. As we shall see in our next episode, the creativity at the core of techno calls attention to speculative visions and transformative actions that closely link to Afrofuturism. The machines at the core of the music are tools, but the visions driving those tools are engaged with deep concerns about culture, community, and things to come. Join me for episode 5, World Building and Techno. If you want to know more about the dynamic story of techno's origins, seek out the 2022 documentary, God Said, Give Them Drum Machines. You can find out more about the documentary at DetroitTechnoMovie.com. You can also learn more by visiting Glimpse Detroit at GlimpseDetroit.com. Glimpse Detroit is an interactive book that recreates Glimpse Magazine, a publication dedicated to chronicling the city's techno culture, created by Billy Love. Artifacts from the Glimpse collection are crucial to our exhibition. Thanks for listening.